From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
A massive victory for Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro, his governing Socialist Party, and progressive forces throughout the Western Hemisphere. Election authorities in Caracas said more than 10 million out of 18 million eligible voters turned out Sunday to elect governors to four-year terms in the country's 23 states. That's a record turnout for off-year balloting in that country. According to private polling companies, it had been predicted that the opposition MUD coalition would win a majority of state governorships, but in fact, they won only 5 out of 23, while Maduro's Socialist Party of Venezuela won 17. Results in one state, Bolivar, had not yet been announced as of press time on Monday. For more on that and what it means for the countries of Latin America and the Caribbean, we spoke with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, from Managua, Nicaragua. Well, it's just about the way you called it on Friday. It's like, I'm very impressed, Tony, I have to say that.
Well, I'm the beneficiary of great knowledge from people in Venezuela, analysts in Venezuela.
You talk to them? You ask people in Venezuela what's going on in Venezuela? Oh, my goodness. What a concept.
Well, I don't actually ask them, apart from a couple of friends who live in Caracas. But
right, me too.
And I've been translating a lot of articles, and the analysis that you get from progressive writers in Venezuela, even those who don't entirely agree with the government of President Nicolas Maduro, is very different to the garbage analysis that passes for foreign affairs coverage in most corporate Western media and also in most progressive media, as to be said, in the West, in North America and Europe.
I got to say one thing. I was looking at the New York Times to see how they reported it. You know, I got up I guess it was a little after midnight New York time and hit Telesur English. Because they said that they would be covering it in real time. I looked at VenezuelaAnalysis.com, and they had promised to do, you know, blow by blow as it happened. I guess they, you know, for some reason they didn't, in any event, not that I could find. So I hit Telesur, and I saw, you know, that there was a huge lopsided victory in favor of the Socialist Party of Venezuela, in favor of the Maduro government's candidates for governor and all of that, that the opposition only won 5 out of whatever, 24 or so elections, and that there's one up in the air, and that the margins, you know, the how out of whack the polls that we were discussing on Friday were, you know, some swing like 25% to 40% from what they said, these polls said on Friday, to what actually happened. And this is pretty remarkable. But it's going to mean, it's a game changer, right? I mean, this is the second demonstration of where the center of gravity lies politically among the people of Venezuela, while the U.S. and everybody are, you know, playing all these, you know, parlor games, trying to, you know, setting up parallel governments and God knows what else.
Yeah, and I don't think the result is going to have much effect on the foreign policy of the United States government or its European allies.
Right. Well,
because, and they're just impervious to facts on the ground.
Right,
and
to reality. Right.
they know what they want. And we've seen this in Syria. And they got away with it in Libya. They got away with it in Ivory Coast. But as soon as Russia and China savvied up and started resisting what the United States and its European allies were trying to do by way of propping up their failing corporate capitalist system. And as soon as Russia and China started defending their own interests, in particular in Syria, this is most clearly seen in Syria.
Yeah, I agree.
Then the facts on the ground started not turning out the way US foreign policy and European Union foreign policy expected. And at that point, instead of recognizing that failure, they just doubled down on doing more of the same. and the facts on the ground didn't go away.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, and there's a remark by George Orwell in his essay on Homage to Catalonia about the civil war in Spain in the 30s, and he says, and the truth goes on existing as it were behind your back, you know, and you can pretend, yeah. you can wish that things were how you'd like, but the truth and the facts on the ground go on existing regardless of what Donald Trump or Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton or Rex Tillerson or any of those people may want,
right,
or their counterparts in the European Union. And you can see that in Venezuela, what happened in Venezuela in 2015, as we've commented on several occasions in our conversations, is that the Chavista vote abstained. And that is why the Venezuelan opposition managed to get an overwhelming majority in the legislature.
Right.
But they have never, even at that time, they never had a majority of the population on their side.
Right.
The people abstained in 2015. It wasn't that the opposition increased their vote. And we've seen that truth and that reality reestablished in these regional elections.
That's
because
right.
All through 2016, all through 2017, the Venezuelan opposition, the right-wing opposition that mobilizes under the alliance known as the Unified Democratic Table, the MUD by its Spanish acronym, they've alienated voters by all those things that we discussed in our last program, the violence, the inability to deliver on their promises, all that stuff. And so by contrast, what Nicolas Maduro did back in whenever it was, May, by calling a National Constituent Assembly to review the country's constitution and make the necessary changes to bring the constitution into accord with Venezuela's current reality. That constitution dates from 1998. Is it 1998 or 1999?
Which, when he was elected, is 98 and took right. office in 99.
All right, so yeah, and the Constituent Assembly was back then, around 1999-2000. And even the opposition recognized that constitution. So when Nicolas Maduro called those elections, he took a huge gamble, because if the vote had failed, and he'd have been finished politically.
Right.
But there was a massive turnout of over 8 million, which is a record for that kind of vote in Venezuela.
That's right. The last time, as a matter of fact, in 2012, the turnout was around 7 million, 7.5 million. And one of the interesting, this is like a bellwether of it. At that time, Enrique Capriles won in Miranda, and that was seen as crucial to, you know, to the MUD grouping, as they're called now. And he won re-election there. And as it turns out, Miranda went to the Socialist Party, to the President's Party, the Government Party, with 51.05% this time. So,
well, and the figure I got was 52.
Yeah, 52.54, right, yeah. Yep.
And that, by the way, is a tremendous victory, because
yep.
it's a massive rebuff to one of the main leaders of the MUD opposition, the MUD
yeah,
opposition.
Right. Yeah, it's a personal rejection of Capriles, for sure.
Yeah, and in an area that is very, very middle class.
Yep.
You know, so it's not, and that's a very significant result for the United Socialist Party of Venezuela, the governing party of Nicolas Maduro. But there are so many wrinkles to this. And if you look at that, if you look at the opposition reaction and what is likely to be the reaction of the United States government and its allies, they're going to say, oh, well, these weren't democratic elections. There was fraud. The opposition in Venezuela always claim that there was fraud and never can never prove it, never establish it.
Even when they won, they were calling Maduro a dictator when they won control of the National Assembly in 2015.
Yeah,
remember that?
Completely absurd. Completely histrionic. But looking at it coldly from the point of view of, you know, what would validate the elections in the eyes of the so-called international community? Well, typically election observers. So were there election observers in these elections? Yes, there were around 1,200 foreign election observers, not from the Organization of American States, of course, but from very well-respected regional bodies like the Latin American Committee of Electoral Experts, the CELA by its Spanish acronym, which is staffed by the people that take part in the CELA missions are all very experienced electoral professionals from across the political spectrum, and they all validated these elections.
Yeah, they post their, you know, there's like a public posting process. The votes are counted at the precinct level publicly. They're posted publicly, and then you can track that posting to the national board. So they're auditable from the ground up. And people have many election observers have referred to the process in Venezuela as the most open and transparent in the world.
Yeah, and for those people who are skeptical about machine voting, and the Venezuelan electoral process, one of the reasons it's so quick is because it's electronic, but it does have a verifiable paper trail.
Yep.
So if there is an audit, there can be an audit of a paper vote. You're not depending on the possibly manipulated digital data.
Right.
So the electoral experts, not just from Latin America, but from around the world, people like the Carter Center, for example, have persistently and consistently reported that Venezuela's electoral system is among the best, if not the best, in the world.
Yep.
So, and cries of fraud from the Venezuelan opposition are typical, completely discredited, but they're still likely to be taken up by the United States government and its European allies.
Well, they haven't figured out yet. How to do this, because there's a really interesting little game that's been going on at the New York Times overnight. Looking at the way the Times has covered this, I'm watching. Excuse me. I've been watching since I started watching the returns come in over Telesur, how the Times covers this. So there's nothing on the front page, and I don't at this moment there may be, but there wasn't even 10 minutes ago. So you have to go to World and then Americas. Well, the top story under the Americas is homes for sale in Toronto. This week's properties are in North Riverdale and Summer Hill. Then a NAFTA battleground on the shores of Canada. And then Nicolas Maduro's party defies polls in Venezuela election, which already tells you that, you know, there's something fishy there, right? Allies of the president of Venezuela, this is the tease, won a lopsided victory, taking 17 governorships compared to 5 for the opposition, but some are crying foul. So you go to this, story, and it's a like a first person, it's like a third person focus on a woman who's voting against the government on the bus. It's in Sucre, Venezuela.
Right.
She had heard the calls for a boycott of the election. She worried that the ruling party might toy with the results and undermine her candidate should he prevail. And the day promised to be a very long one. The government had relocated her voting site from the place she had cast ballots since 1972 to a distant, crime-ridden neighborhood. That's how it starts. They don't tell you anything until the seventh paragraph but late Sunday night, Venezuelan officials announced it was President Maduro's governing party that had scored a lopsided victory, taking 17 governorships, while the opposition won only 5, with the results of one state hanging. That's how they reported it.
Yeah, that result is actually an improvement for the opposition.
Yeah, that's right.
Because they previously only had, what was it, 4? Yeah. And now they've certainly got five. They might get six because there's one governorship still in the balance because the vote's so close.
Yep. So then it says neither Venezuela nor the world buys it, says Gerardo Blyde, an opposition leader. The government itself cannot explain the results. That's how the Times reports this. It's like a, you know, it's almost like, well, it is fiction, but it's almost like a novel, you know?
There's no surprise there, is there? The New York Times, the Washington Post, and almost all those media are straight out media outlets for the State Department, in effect,
most
of the time.
So
if you look at that, it's unlikely to change U.S. policy. From the United States government point of view, the vote is a setback, but they're going to continue with their sanctions, their threats of military intervention, their attempts to isolate Venezuela diplomatically. They'll continue with their efforts in support of Luis Almagro in the Organization of American States to set up a spurious parallel government. What they'll probably do is they'll say, oh, well, look, on the basis of this fraud, we have to set up a complete parallel government. So they may well go ahead and do that. But on the ground in Latin America, you're likely to see a very different response.
That's right.
Because in Latin America, the Venezuelan people recognize that the Venezuelan electoral system is very efficient and gives true and fair results. And so it'll be very difficult for even the likes of Mauricio Macri and Michel Temer in Brazil, the usurper president in Brazil, Mauricio Macri, the president of Argentina. It'll be very difficult for them to call into question in a credible way in Latin American forums, the Venezuelan election result. And for people looking at it from a continental point of view, looking at Latin America and the Caribbean, it's a very strong indication that the so-called conservative restoration never happened.
Yeah.
You know, it's a myth.
Well, you know, when they first started describing the phenomenon that was, you know, that started happening with Chavez in 98, they were calling it the pink tide at the time.
Remember?
And so if you want to use that metaphor, then you've had an ebb and flow of the tides. And, you know, the conservative restoration, quote unquote, if you can call coups d'etat and, you know, and a couple of elections, two elections, really. It was an election in Argentina with a whole lot of monkeying, by the way, and what they would refer to in the United States as meddling. And the National Assembly election in Venezuela, you know, under a condition where their economy was suffering a hell of a lot more than just meddling. I mean, if you could imagine Russia doing to the United States last year what the United States did to Venezuela's economy leading into 2015 election. Those are the only two actual markers of this so-called conservative restoration. The coup that put Temer in power, the coup that got rid of Mel Zelaya, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Those are not really indications of anything but the U.S. expressing dominance, you know, physical dominance. So it reached its peak already. The highest tide has already happened and being just as they described, more or less. And now, you know, it ebbs again. And so you're going to see Macri's got to be looking at this, let alone Temer, who stands on 2%.
Absolutely, Don. And that's absolutely right. And the right-wing government's got into power on a bunch of false promises that have now been shown to be hollow. And now people are reacting against them.
Right.
And so and even in Venezuela, which, as you say, has been subject to fierce economic sanctions, persistent economic sabotage by the opposition, by the political opposition and their business sector backers. They've been subject to attempts at diplomatic isolation that have failed miserably in the Organization of American States because of Venezuela's prestige as a factor for stability, directly contrary to the ridiculous propaganda of the United States State Department. Venezuela has been a tremendous force for stability in the Caribbean, assisting Caribbean island nation states with their very, very difficult energy problems, and also, to some extent, with their food security problems.
Yep.
So in the OAS, the United States has failed to isolate Venezuela. And this result gives tremendous legitimacy and credibility to the government of President Nicolas Maduro. It puts the opposition in a situation where whatever they say outside Venezuela about fraud, inside Venezuela, they know very well they were well and truly beaten.
Yep.
In electoral terms. So the pressure on them will be, well, the population will be looking at them and saying, you've been saying for years that your policies will improve lives for ordinary people. You now have five, possibly six governorships, so show us what you can do.
That's right, show us.
And they're going to have to do that over the next year in the run-up to the presidential elections that are going to be held in Venezuela. I understand it, as I understand it, in the first days of December.
Yeah.
And all the signs now are that Nicolas Maduro and his ministerial team have worked out policies that may not completely solve the economic difficulties facing Venezuela's economy and people, but they'll go a long way to mitigate them. And that should be enough, combined with the predictable failure of the MUD opposition to do anything positive in terms of the well-being of people in Venezuela, right, including in the governorships that they've just done. And that'll create a situation where President Nicolas Maduro is likely to get re-elected in December of next year.
Well, let's see. Actually, if you were to go to Wikipedia today, just like we went to Wikipedia on Friday, looking at the listing of public opinion polls on that question, you'll see that MUD is going to win the presidential election somewhere between 55 and 65% to somewhere between 12 and 35%.
Well, and if we go by the results of those, the real results of in these elections as against the results the polls predicted, that confirms our prediction.
That's exactly right.
Nicolas Maduro is going to win probably with something between 50 and 55%.
Yeah, they might give him a beach house and another second car or something at the end of the election if it goes the way it went yesterday. You know.
Well, The opinion polls in Venezuela aren't worth the paper they're published on.
Well, that's, you know, CNN and CBS, and we had all those polls last year. Hillary Clinton won the election, right? She was ahead like 20%, I think, at the
It was the Russians. Or it must have been the Russians then.
I forgot about them, those pesky Russians. You know, there's something else. This is something that kind of, you know, I've been trying to process this for a good long while now. You know, we have the Monroe Doctrine. We have a history from Monroe, even before Monroe articulated it really, forward of U.S. To call it intervention is to be gentle, but of U.S. intervention in the affairs of all of the other governments and societies in the Western Hemisphere, among others. And, you know, we had a while, I would say certainly with the end of World War II, sort of a completely unrestrained imperial, you know, activity towards the whole world. The pushback in Vietnam that taught a lesson to at least American society that the politicians and the media term the Vietnam syndrome, which is that, hey, guess what? Just because you go in there doesn't mean that you're going to be able to take everything, and people might fight back, and some of them successfully. You've had that lesson taught to the U.S. and also the example of Cuba. So I don't know what the role of the 1962 so-called missile crisis was in keeping Cuba free and independent of the United States, or just the way they organized the CDRs, and, you know, the fact that anybody going in there knows that they're going to be in for a protracted war, not just a, you know, we're going to conquer and occupy it, but rather they're going to be blowing us up every day and they're going to fight to the last person. I don't know how much of all of that shapes policy. We got a peek into how the U.S. now behaves, like in Iraq, where first they starve you, they, you know, strip you of your weapons, they starve your people, they do all of this for 10 or 15 years, and then they make war on you. So I don't know what the model is that's in the mindset, but certainly they have to look at the popular support for the Socialist Party, Maduro, and the Bolivarian Revolution inside Venezuela and know that they can't just put together an OAS army and occupy it without looking at, you know, basically body bags coming home somewhere that ultimately are going to lead to people on the streets in the United States. And so every time there's an election like this in Venezuela, I think it drives that point home to the folks in Washington and Langley.
Yeah, and also throughout the region. And it's definitely a setback for U.S. Yeah. policy. I mean, obviously, U.S. policy in the region is more guided by what they did achieve in Libya and what they hoped unsuccessfully to achieve in Syria. And I think that's the model that they're trying to apply in Venezuela.
Yeah.
And I think there's very little likelihood of the United States sending its own military in, apart from special forces, in any putative invasion.
Right.
They'll use paramilitaries from Colombia.
Right.
But that scenario seems to me to have receded significantly as a result of this regional election victory by the United Socialist Party of Venezuela.
You know,
Go ahead.
So, you know, well, you had mentioned also, in addition to that, you know, you had mentioned about the pushback by Russia and China over Syria, you know, at the UN and elsewhere we're talking about. And, you know, they started to assert after what happened in Libya and some others, because we saw the U.S. looking at stripping TARDIS military base from Russia, which wasn't really that active, but, you know, strategically it was a spot that could be useful in the event of all-out war. And then even trying to strip away, you know, the base in Crimea, which is historically, you know, I mean, there's been a Russian naval base in Crimea longer than there's been a United States of America. And so at some point they started to push back, and we saw it at the United Nations. And so, you know, the first piece of real estate that they pushed out towards was Syria, which is kind of a rear guard spot for the Russians because you've got Turkey in between and such. So, but then Crimea is like front line. I'm thinking, let's say they get involved in low intensity warfare a la Vietnam. You know, the cards are so different now. China can crank out rifles and jeeps and bazookas and helicopters or whatever for 1,000 years without really draining the economy there, which is a condition that didn't exist with the USSR or China 50 years ago or even 30 or 20 years ago. You know, Russia has strategic parity with the United States in terms of, look, if you blow us up, we can blow you up, and that's that. So that kind of keeps that stuff off the table. The political condition in Latin America has changed dramatically since the 60s, even since 98. What are they, so their options are like kind of, you know.
Yeah, and also Don, and the in Venezuela, that you have this situation where since 1998, Comandante Hugo Chavez and now President Nicolas Maduro have built up a very strong civic military union, so that the Venezuelan armed forces, where while there may be pockets of opposition sympathizers within them, overwhelmingly support the government.
That's
and
right.
they have a structural civil defense, military defense organization that includes millions of ordinary Venezuelans.
And that
wasn't the case in Libya, for example.
Right, in Bolivarian circles, which are, you know, more analogous to the committees for the defense of revolution in Cuba. You know, we're going to have to get back into this next week, but just as a parting shot, you know, one of the most interesting things about what's happened is that both Argentina and Brazil are in such a precarious situation in terms of their governments, and elections are coming up. And I'm wondering if we might not see that pink tide turn red and maybe envelop a good part of the hemisphere. And we'll have to talk about that as it goes on. So thanks, Tony.
Okay, thanks a million, Don.
I'll speak with you soon. I'm certainly looking forward to it. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.